This is an interview for the Avon Heathcote Estuary Ihutai Trust. It's the 12th of June. The equipment is the Fostex field recorder and two lapel microphones. The interviewer, Michelle Bradley, and the interviewee, Professor Kevin O'Connor. It's being recorded in Kevin's study of his home on Clifton. This is session two on the 12th of June. We have had a bit of a break, and I've asked Kevin to recommence the interview by just again returning to some of the content in the session that we've already done, particularly about his first experience of cycling out. And he tells me that he took a photograph, and that the photograph is quite a good... Oh, well, Kevin, you just connect it as to how you would like to.
All right.
You just make a start. If I haven't phrased that quite to your liking, you just kick off where you'd like to.
Well, I came out here, as I told you, in 1948, cycling alongside the estuary and back around it on my trip out to Sumner and back, before I completed the tour of the South Island by bicycle. So I mentioned I went up to Picton from Christchurch by train with the bicycle in the van, because I was due to commence university at Wellington in 2 days' time, and I had to come back later to complete the bicycle circuit from Christchurch to Picton. The interesting thing on my first journey out beside the estuary, as I said, was that the estuary seemed to me to be fairly decrepit. It had muddy banks in it rather than sandbanks. It didn't have a whole lot of vitality, obvious in terms of its shellfish life or crabs scurrying around or anything like that. It compared poorly for me with what I remembered from Bayswater in Auckland. And yet it had the skerrick of recreational use, signified at that stage by a few boats moored in Monk's Bay. No boats out on the water because the tidal conditions were not right. On a later trip, again by bicycle, I remembered coming, by this time it was by motorcycle. I had been down in the Otago working on my survey of land use in the Upper Clutha, and I was going over by ferry, taking the motorbike on the ferry from Littleton, and I remember stopping down there at Simpson's Corner. Simpson's Corner is a stone bus shelter built at the western end of Monk's Bay, where Monk's Bay comes into the shopping area of Redcliffs. And from there I took a picture of the boat harbour, the boat shed, and Clifton Hill behind it, thickly occupied with houses and niobe trees and looking every bit a lovely seaside suburb. I remember how beautiful it looked, and I took that picture with me, and I had it developed. It was one of my treasures going off to America. Among other things, I remember showing that to Margaret's family in a slideshow I gave them, along with a lovely picture that I had of up above Dampier Bay in Wanaka, and some other charming scenes of tussock grasslands in different places, all part of my how beautiful it is message about New Zealand to my future in-laws. Margaret, I remember, was especially taken with this picture of Clifton and Monk's Bay at the foot of it. She dwelt on that. We didn't know at the time, but that was where we came back to live.
So you met your wife, Margaret, while you were studying in the States?
Yes, I met her at my 29th birthday party, was it? I think so. Which was held in the flat of some of my friends who had a flat in the same house as Margaret and her friend Carol had a flat. So we invited the neighbours into the party, and that's when I met Margaret.
And Margaret's full name?
Margaret Mary Schmieg, S-C-H-M-I-E-G. Quarter Irish, quarter Scots, quarter French, quarter German, all-American, mathematician, doing a MA in mathematics at Cornell at the time. Her undergraduate degree had been done at the Jesuit University at Le Moyne, where she graduated summa cum laude, you know, the top draw in theology, mathematics, and a few other things. She's a bright lady. And very lovely, black hair and blue eyes. Combination I'd always been on the lookout for. We came to New Zealand after completing my PhD at Cornell, travelled through a bit through Europe and round the Cape of Good Hope to Australia in a Dutch freighter, which was supposed to go through the Mediterranean and the Suez, but didn't because Anthony Eden and Mr. Nasser of Egypt had a dispute at the time. So that's why we came round the Cape of Good Hope and across to Australia. We arrived in New Zealand at the end of 1956. I had a job to start in tussock grasslands, work at the Department of Agriculture. Having been on leave from the public service to do my PhD, on leave without pay, I can assure you. Well, we lived like church mice in Worcester Street for 2 or 3 years. I remember the devil's own job to scrape together enough for a deposit on a section how could you possibly build a house? So you were forced to rent. And I came out to visit a cousin who lived on Tuawera Terrace. And I had been contemplating a section up on Kennedy's Bush Road in above Hallsville. I hadn't been to inspect this section, but I knew it was available. And I wanted to get up off the flat in Christchurch. You can't see much from the flat. And I came out to see John and Elizabeth, my cousins, and their family, living on Tuawera Terrace. And John took me along the road and showed me an old house and spare section alongside it that were up for sale at ridiculously low price in those days. I had no money, as I say. I had prospects. The short story was that we bought the old house. We spent about £350 on making it livable. We bought the spare section along with it, and we set to make a new life in the sun.
And you brought with you, your family had already, you'd already started your...
We started a family at that stage. We had two little ones. And I think this was in 'August or September of 58. We had Elizabeth and Martin at that stage. We didn't have a car, which was a bit of a limitation on living on a hill. But we had some good neighbours who used to give us rides down the hill to church. And I used to keep my bicycle in a cave at the foot of Mulgan's track and ride into the city to work at Lincoln, to work at Department of Ag, and if need be go on from there out to the high country or whatever, because sometimes I was away for 2 or 3 days.
So what was the acreage? What was the...
5/8 of an acre.
And the outlook?
Expansive, all the way from Porter's Pass round through the Pukaturaki, the Kaikouras, all the way to South America. It's a great place for outlook. And the foreground for half the arc in front of you was the estuary. And
concluding round?
All the stretch from the foot of the spit all the way round to Humphreys Drive. You could see in one sweep. And it was something that you saw every morning as you went down to get the paper and you said your prayers and you brought up the milk and the day started. And you got used to the estuary and its rhythm. And I had been taken with the potential of the estuary for recreation. It seemed to me a very attractive prospect. Mucking about in boats seemed to me to be the height of what Canterbury needed to be about. And there was a good place to start here on the estuary, but you were limited by the tide and the shallowness of the water at half tide, in so much of it. And people who had recreational interests used to complain to me of having to pay attention to when you needed to pull your centreboard up and so on. Now, I didn't know at that stage that owning a boat and caring for a boat and recreating for a boat was a comparatively expensive business. You had to have some sort of disposable income to do that sort of thing. Some of my children, Elizabeth notably, did enjoy crewing on friends' boats a bit, and Frank got into the enterprise of rafting on the estuary with the Boy Scouts and so on. But gradually I found that I was starting to think like the estuary instead of thinking like simply a father aiming to make use of the estuary for the recreation of his family. We enjoyed the beach at Sumner. We could enjoy the tide in or tide out there. We knew that and understood the beach at Clifton. The estuary seemed to be telling its own message. And the more I thought on this at the time, the more did I see that it was trying to tell the whole city something. It was, in fact, a quietly pulsing organ in the centre of the city organism. It was like a heart with a regular beat in an ordinary body. It was in and out twice a day. Everything about it adjusting to that diurnal rhythm. And I noticed, when you've reflected on it, that the wise recreational people were planning their boating courses to suit that. When low tide beset them, this really small boats, the P-class and so on, used to have a course right down under the spur of, or the western spur of Clifton, right alongside Shag Rock. And the pilot boat for them used to post itself just out on the bar so that any emergencies could be followed by a quick rescue. That would happen certain days of the year when the tide demanded it. There were still the motorboats going over at speeding round a racecourse sized circuit out in front of the Avon mouth. And traversing over water, the sound from them was hideous. on Clifton.
Would that happen over a weekend, Kevin?
And it seemed to happen at summer weekends. And it was initially, I believe, under protest from a whole lot of people, it was reduced to something like 5 days in the year, and then to 2 days in the year or something, and then finally extirpated from the estuary altogether. Not in our backyard anymore. I was glad to see the end of those things. It always struck me as a very energy wasteful sort of thing to skim over water and recreationally in a powerboat. But I could understand the joy that certain people had, just as Johannes Anderson described it as a particular kind of joyous recreation.
What do you think was the common view, say around that time? I think from my reading that's that time of the discussion about the powerboats was in, I think, about the 1970. So what do you think was the common held view, the one that you mentioned that came upon you with living here and getting more a sense of the estuary as a living organism, or the aquatic playground, or do you think it was a mixture of the two?
I think that the different yachting clubs and windsurfers and so on, and they were the principal users numerically. They adjusted to the tides. I don't think people generally adjusted to the rhythm of the estuary. And I don't think that the symbolism got through to anybody. I'm not sure, but I think I'm the only person that I've known who's coined this idea of the pulse of the heart.
Well, certainly the term the kidney is used.
Sure, it functions as the kidney, the kidneys. It didn't have to, and it shouldn't ought to, but it did. But we mustn't go into puns on aortas.
Would you like to come back to your main line of thought, Kevin?
Yeah. People used to, at that stage in the piece, city council and all sorts of people used to boast of the estuary. As a jewel in the crown. Pretty grubby jewel. As the treasure. Not very valued treasure. Not very treasured value either. I think that there's been a lot of public hypocrisy about the estuary. And I can remember the night when we in the Estuary Association had to protest in order to get onto the program when the City Council was launching a great big so-called interchange of views on the estuary. gifted leader of Friends of the Estuary had his lovely ballad of the Royal Flush we were simply treating the estuary as a dump, organic and nutrient dump, and relying on uncared for estuary processes to get rid of our wastes. And it was really from my indignation at that and the consequences of it, of the failure of the natural system to cope with the cultural burdens that we were loading on it, that caused me to look around for ways and means to get involved.
How did you experience the deterioration?
Well, I often used to have the bicycle in at Days Motors there while I was out at Lincoln and come home by bicycle. And coming home by bicycle was no longer the exhilarating experience during the 70s that it had been in the late 50s. Sea lettuce was well established now in the estuary, and at this stage in the piece the estuary was not coping with it. The lack of oxygenation, until the oxidation ponds were well and truly developed, the lack of oxygenation meant that the discharge from Romney to the estuary already had a high biological oxidation demand, and the sea lettuce that was nourished by our nutrients was decomposing in anaerobic conditions. And when sea lettuce or any other vegetation decomposes in anaerobic conditions, you're going to get the emission of hydrogen sulfide. I can remember that our old garage down at the roadside had been painted in white paint with ordinary lead oxides paint, and it blackened like many of the houses of Mount Pleasant. The advent of acrylic paints meant that people could repaint their houses in ways that they didn't go black with the hydrogen sulfide. Your silver still went black if it was genuine silver. If it was stainless steel, that showed in the non-tarnish. But it was offensive on the nose. If you wanted to live in Rotorua, you could, and you got adjusted to it. But you didn't have the chance to get adjusted to it because it wasn't constant here. A balmy nor'wester evening could be the pain. And that was a sign of the rottenness within. Now, the rottenness in the estuary was, I felt, symbolic of the rottenness of our culture. It was the same sort of rottenness as I felt affected Australian rural culture that generated dust storms out of the Mallee. Back and affected the Ian Moody and the Jindy Waterback poets years before. And I felt that it was all very well my emphasis on restoring sanity and natural ecology in the high country, which was the bulk of my life. There'd been enough erosion off the Port Hills, mostly in the cause of urban subdivision, to cause quite a lot of muddying of the Heathcote and muddying of the estuary deposits from the Heathcote. So that told me that the Port Hills had to be part of my concern too. But the estuary itself needed to have my love and understanding. And somehow or another, if I could get some understanding and turn that to account with people who also love the estuary, maybe we could have it function as the living and undiseased heart of the city. It didn't have to be right at the centre of the city. The main aorta was the Avon, we'd already turned our back on the Avon at this stage in the centre of the city, and it took a special kind of renaissance, quietly led, as it happened, by landscape architects for the city and its people to turn back and take real pleasure in the good functioning of the Avon through the city.
Did you want to make mention of anyone in particular with regards to that?
Neil Aiken was my particular medium to it, but Charlie Challenger was also, I think, very much part of that renaissance of attitude. It diffused quite a bit through city council culture, and the whole of the city council now has a culture through a great deal of its structure of respect for the fact that Christchurch is a city in a wetland. It is a continuing wetland, and their devices that they have created for water management, of excess water management, urban overflows, respect that condition in quite a way. But don't get me wrong, they've still got a long way to go, because even when we get the nutrients and excess energy of organic matter out of the estuary, we still have the pollution caused by the pollution of the riverways. And that's everything from traffic dust and dog shit to the sweepings from everybody's doorstep. Plus, I suppose, a lot of lawn clippings still from the suburban gardens, which is such a beautiful part of Christchurch City. Lots of people still dump their lawn clippings in the Avon, you know, and some of the best parts of Christchurch.
Now, I would like to give you an opportunity if you'd like to make any concluding remarks for today's session, but could you give me a time reference for the acknowledgement of the Neil Aiken, the landscape architect's actions?
No, it's a continuing thing spread over a number of years. I think you'd have to spend a bit more attention. I'd have to spend more attention identifying particular things. George Malcolm was certainly part of it. Now, George was led the architect landscape section or something in the Ministry of Works and Development. Neil worked with him before Neil was sent out to Lincoln to do his landscape degree. I think it was all sorts of people's thinking rather than particular projects which did it. See, I remember Neil's major project was in fact that landscaping the landscape design elements in the Northern Motorway. Now, there's so much pleasurable driving that you have on that motorway that you don't realize how beautifully it's been integrated into the landscape until you pay attention to things. That was Neil's work for the Ministry of Works. Other people have done other things by way of the orientation of city buildings. Certainly the whole of the zone of the, from the provincial buildings, which were my original offices in Armagh Street, all the way around in the justice section to the town hall, that orientation of that has made a whole new view of the city for itself. I think that what's been going on there is what I'll call environmental sensitivity at a micro scale. What I think still needs to happen in Christchurch as a whole is the big transformation at a macro scale, and that will come about only when we recognize that we are all living in a particular kind of wetland system, that we are living in a wetland at the foot of a expansive dryland system, which is the plains, and another different kind of dry system, which is the Port Hills. And if we don't understand that somehow or other the estuary and its two tributaries differently fed according to those two dryland systems, and the Waimak to the northern boundary, they constitute a whole big vascular system, which gives you all sorts of pleasurable ways of reflection, as well as design in the way that you need to do things in order to continue to live an urban life. You can do that. We've got another one again at the Waihora, the Ellesmere, because Waihora can't function as a anyway natural system unless it builds up its content of fresh water. But we don't let it do that. We have prescriptions for opening the spit there, Kaitareti spit, to the sea. So we ensure that there's saltwater interchange, and we never have the build-up of fresh water that is necessary for the re-establishment of the rupia beds, which are the primary feedstuff of duck populations. I had a French student who did his PhD with me who came across that virtually by reflective accident. He's works in the New Zealand conservation system now, and I think eventually we will have the likes of the Waihora system respected for what it needs to be at the moment. This all came about with him setting to try to discover the reason for the disappearance of the rupia beds. They disappeared after the Waihini storm, I think it was.
Mm.
They never recovered.
Did you want to name that student?
Oh yeah, that's Philippe Gerbeau. Philippe is technical officer in the Department of Conservation, and I met him again the other day because after working in the Pacific office of IUCN for 5 years, he's now back in Christchurch. Allez les bleus. He can go to Dunedin this weekend to support the French rugby.
Now that was an interesting digression.
Yes.
Would you like to make any concluding comment or remarks?
Everything is connected to everything else.
That's right.
There's no such thing as a digression.
But the necessity is for you to go and have some lunch now, so I just want to give
what
you...
What about you?
Well, we'll finish here, but yes. is there anything else that you would like to finish with?
I think the daily observation of the estuary, especially in the years when I was painfully breaking in this retrograde sections, a mass of convolvulus, prairie grass, fennel, decayed rock walls, and broken pipelines. My chief weapon used to have to be mattock and periodic fire.
Hello, I wonder if you could please ring back. I shall tell him. Thank you, Margaret. The breaking in of the section.
It could never be done and be unconscious of the estuary. I never used to look up the tide tables. I used to read the tide from the estuary. I was able to look at the estuary. It taught me how to look at it and see whether the tide was coming in or going out. It had a different appearance. You could look at it instantly and tell. That started to affect me, that what nature had to teach, and that was affecting my whole of my professional life, working in the plains and mountains and so on elsewhere, not just in the estuary. It spent best part of 20 years making a nature conservationist out of me, who was previous to that a nature adaptionist, if you like. Is that significant? I think it is. Should we end there?
Thank you very much.